Hello and welcome to the Majlis Central Asia podcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. With total investment reaching to an astonishing figure of $1 trillion or more, China's One Belt, One Road project, in other words, OBOR, is one of the biggest ambitious initiatives of the decade. Potentially covering about 65% of the world's population, one-third of the world's GDP, and about a quarter of all the goods and services the world moves, the significant part of the OBOR involves poorly developed Central Asia. As a result, there are mixed feelings about the project and its possible implications to the region. To discuss the subject and what does it mean to Central Asia today, on the Majlis, we have a distinguished expert participating from around the globe. From UK, Dr. David Lewis, a senior lecturer at the Exeter University, is joining us. He is a former Central Asia researcher at the Crisis Group and author of an upcoming report on Central Asia leg of OBOR. Dr. Davis, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Very nice to have you, Dr. Lewis. From Geneva, I have Cholopon Uruzubekova. She is a journalist and researcher originally from Kyrgyzstan. Cholopon, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. From Prague, I'm joined by Bruce Panier, who is the editor of Kishlak Owozi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog. Bruce, welcome to the Majlis.
Always good to be here.
Thank you, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, for joining the debate. Before to kick off, let me remind you, please feel free to amplify, expand, or disagree directly with the points other guests are making. Please don't wait for me to prompt you a question so that we have a lively debate today. With this, Dr. Lewis, let's start with you. Whomever you talk about OBOR, you hear one explanation that it's a huge project, a game changer. How big is that, and how the OBOR's Central Asia sections looks like?
Well, it's a very difficult question to answer because OBOR, as you mentioned, some people give headline figures of $1 trillion, but in reality, of course, there's very few clear, concrete goals that the Chinese government has set yet. In many ways, it's a very rhetorical project. There's lots of very exciting-sounding rhetoric around it, lots of meetings and summits and research reports, but so far, many of the projects that you see that are now called OBOR were things that actually the Chinese government was doing already in Central Asia, such as building railway links across Kazakhstan, or, for example, recent railways opening in Uzbekistan between Angren and Pav, was conceived before the idea of OBOR came forward. But because China is involved in these projects, they now often get sort of lumped together as part of this much bigger project. So we have to be careful about saying OBOR is doing this or that. It's more, in a way, a kind of umbrella idea for the way that China is presenting itself, where it's investing in Central Asia, and the broad kind of vision it has over the long term for how Central Asia will fit within its foreign policy. But that doesn't mean it's not going to happen just because there's a little bit, should we say, some empty rhetoric around it. There's a lot of political commitment by this big initiative of Xi Jinping. It's something the Chinese leadership is committed to. And it does involve significant funding for Central Asia in particular. And, of course, governments and elites in Central Asia are very enthusiastic about getting that funding flowing into major infrastructure projects.
Dr. David, you mentioned that China is already building parts of that project or already building on the existing projects. What are some of those? Do you have any details?
Well, there's a mix. I mean, the main focus for China has been initially on energy. So the series of important pipelines, Kazakhstan-China pipeline, oil pipeline, gas pipelines from Turkmenistan. These, of course, linked to China's need for increasing strategic autonomy, fearful about potential conflict in East Asia. Central Asia gives it an alternative source of energy that doesn't require the shipping lanes through East Asia. So the pipelines are important. And then these new rail and transport links that are opening up across Kazakhstan, for example, new railway links to link East Kazakhstan and West Kazakhstan right across to the Caspian, and also increased rail links in Uzbekistan. I mentioned inside Tajikistan, there's been some improvement there, and improvements in the road infrastructure in Kyrgyzstan, for example, from the Chinese border across southern Kyrgyzstan. Lots still to do in that area, but it is in raising up some important and interesting potential transport links. So, for example, this year we saw the first trains ever to go from China across to Iran, and there's a new railway going from Kazakhstan down to Turkmenistan. And the first trains also arrived this year, this summer, in Afghanistan. It's the first train from China to Afghanistan. So although it's very early days, these are not commercially viable routes at the moment, it's opening up the idea of Central Asia as a route through which goods and people might flow, as opposed to what it is often at the moment, kind of place where borders are very difficult and transportation is very difficult. So China is trying to change that equation.
Bruce, let's come to the objective here. What do you think the driving factor behind this from the Chinese perspective?
You know, I think that's pretty easy to answer. China, you know, they want to be, they already are a huge trading country anyway, and they trade with just about everybody. They just want to expand that network so that they can sell more of their stuff and import the things that they need. You know, which to date, there's a lot of things they need, but as far as Central Asia goes to date, it's been pretty much energy resources. But that said, Central Asia would be an ideal transit region for a lot of goods that would come out of, say, the Persian Gulf or something. Again, China's obsession is with energy resources, and they're a little bit wary about the ocean tanker transport, because it has to go through the Straits of Malacca, which has been a pirate and infested zone for quite a while. And they're also worried that in times of conflict, it might be easy to block some of their maritime import routes for energy resources, oil specifically. So they would prefer to have one of these overland routes, which is much quicker, in most cases much safer, and not only gets China what they need in terms of imports, but as I said, would allow China to export more broadly in greater quantity.
Cholapan, what are the expectations of Central Asians from Obor? Are they on the same page with China on this? What are they thinking, for example, in your country, Kyrgyzstan, when people talk about Obor?
People, they don't know about Obor. I think there are not much information about that. And the problem is that Kyrgyzstan and other Central Asia countries, now they are overwhelmed with the EU, Eurasia Economic Union. And when it comes to the Obor and EU, there's a little bit clash, I think, between them, because currently Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, they joined EU with Russia.
Right.
So there are so many problems within this organization. For example, let's take Kyrgyzstan. Kyrgyzstan became a WTO member already in 1998, right? So during this last 20 years, almost 20 years, Kyrgyzstan was enjoying the trade with China according to WTO tariffs. Now Kyrgyzstan is struggling with these discrepancies between EU and WTO tariffs. And now, for example, China suggested to create a free trade zone within the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So this means China is trying to return this trade relationship with Kyrgyzstan.
Right.
So China wants to enter this kind of mutual trade agreements, you know, and I think Kyrgyzstan, all Central Asian countries, of course, they would like to be a trade partner with China. First, China has own privileges, like, for example, China has diversified goods, cheap prices, and well-established channels of merchandise. So this means that for small countries like Kyrgyzstan with economic turmoil, this is good opportunity. For example, in 2013, trade between China and five Central Asian states was 50 billion already.
Right.
While, for example, trade between Russia and these countries, only 30 million, right. billion. So this means China was already economic hegemon at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So, and currently, with the creation of the Eurasia Economic Union, there is a decline in the trade, but all Central Asian countries, they are ready to cooperate with China in the framework of Obor, I think. As Professor Lewis highlighted, Obor is still on the paper. There is no concrete agreements under the umbrella of Obor. So I think there are still many, many years to go to implement this project concretely, I think. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we will talk about that. Dr. Lewis, I'm coming back to you. As Chulpan said, and you also hinted earlier that some projects are going on and some are not yet clear. So if you can answer this question, I don't know, but if you do, the day after when this project is launched, whenever that is, what expected to happen in Central Asia? What changes a Central Asian farmer in Kyrgyzstan or a Tajik entrepreneur should expect to happen?
Yeah, it's not going to be, as it were, one day you don't have a project, next day you do. It's going to be an ongoing process, and it's going to be much vaguer than you might think, right? Hmm. And it's interesting, it was good that Chopin raised the question of you, Eurasian Economic Union, because these are very different projects, right, in their structure. Eurasian Economic Union has a superstructure, lots of rules. Chinese approach is very different. They don't want lots of rules or lots of bureaucracy. It's much more flexible, and it means that China can do quite high-level deals with governments in ways that that it wants to. And lots of these are quite high-level projects, often government-to-government or involving state companies from China. So one thing is, you know, you might see some improvement, certainly in living standards, in raising economic growth in some of these countries. For example, China is working on the reconstruction of the Bishkek heating and power station. So hopefully that will improve heating in Bishkek. But of course, there are also problems with these projects. They are very high-level projects. They're often government-to-government. They are often very beneficial for elites in Central Asia. But you mentioned farmers. It's not clear that they will necessarily benefit lots of ordinary people. There's also questions about governance, about corruption involved in some of these processes. And so when there's large amounts of money coming in, it can be very difficult to manage that money effectively. So I think there's also going to be some problems arising with some of these big projects. And they may have some unexpected and negative effects in society as well.
What does it say, Dr. Lewis, about the the biggest problem that Central Asians are facing these days are unemployment? So what does it say about unemployment or free flow of labor force?
Yeah, so the one of the advantages of the Eurasian Economic Union is, of course, that it does help labor migrants somewhat from Kyrgyzstan, for example. And many ordinary people in Central Asia, their main hope of employment is by traveling to Russia and getting jobs there, or traveling to Kazakhstan. Those flows are decreasing now because of the Russian economic problems. But nevertheless, that's one way out of unemployment. China doesn't offer that kind of labor migration, right? There's no real option of going to China to work. And one of the problems with Chinese investment is it often involves hiring Chinese labor to come and work in Central Asia. So typically, Chinese companies like to use their own people, bring in Chinese labor to get a job done. It's often very effective, but it doesn't always give people local jobs and employ local specialists.
I think
one of the problems will be this impact on society will be the Chinese investment, although it often involves large amounts of funding, doesn't always create quite as much employment as we might like.
Right. So there is an article, or according to your opinion, that this allows a flow of labor migrants. Is that correct understanding?
You mean the Chinese project?
Ubor, I mean, in general.
Ubor, no. There's no allowance for free migration or for easier cross-border travel. The only thing that it does include, of course, is an attempt to improve transport connections, or in other words, improve the concrete infrastructure. Now, China has talked about improving cross-border trade, cross-border travel, cooperation between people, but that's really largely at a rhetorical level at present. Even if you build the infrastructure, it's not clear that it's going to improve trade across the Uzbek-Kyrgyz border, for example. And that's one of the problems with the project, is that it's all very well to build roads and to build railways, but you also have to improve border crossings, customs procedures, and so on and so forth. And that's the political problem, really, that the Chinese project has not yet come to terms with.
At least on the official agenda, it sounds like I read it from several articles that China, with this project, wants to improve cross-border connections and people-to-people connections and all these things. So what about the investment and trade? What advantages does it bring? Should an entrepreneur decide to move to a new market across the border?
Well, above all, of course, it produces funding, right? It's his major source of investment funding for Central Asian governments and for Central Asian companies. And that includes, of course, Chinese investors coming into the economic structures inside Central Asia, right? Mm. So there'll be lots of investment potentially in manufacturing, in the power sector, and potentially in agriculture.
Yeah.
But all these potential investments have potential problems with them, right? So in agriculture, there's a lot of sensitivity about China being leased land, particularly in Kazakhstan. We've seen that recently. In the power sector, many of these companies can be very polluting, can have a negative impact on the environment. So none of this is without costs, right? So the high level of financing also has potential negative impacts on social stressors and on the environment. So this is why it's an important issue to be discussed within Central Asian societies, to try and formulate a way of managing this process effectively.
Right. And Bruce, as Dr. Lewis was saying, that there is an opportunity for the Chinese investors coming into Central Asia, or if wishes, Central Asian investors going to a cross-border. So in this case, imagine this Chinese investors coming to Central Asia. In terms of production, does the Central Asian market stand the chance to compete with this new reality?
Oh, that is a good question. You know, I mean, like, as I said a few minutes ago, Central Asia is going to become mainly a transit zone on this, so they're going to have a lot of goods coming and going through their territory. Now, whether they can keep up with that is a good question. I should also point out that although we throw out that figure of $1 trillion potential dollars that are going into this, you know, China of course is not putting up all that money or even close to all that money. They're looking to hook up with local investors along the way to help them develop that section of the route.
At least $40 billion is coming from China, I believe.
That's true. But out of $1 trillion, $40 billion is not a lot. And so the Central Asians, they're going to have to look toward training a lot more people for the services sector and get away from agriculture. You know, they'll be able to export some of their goods for sure, but a lot of stuff is going to be imported too. And under such a structure, I don't know how competitive their agricultural products are going to be, to tell you the truth. So they're going to need to train people for services. Another thing that Dr. Lewis mentioned that's really important to remember too is that one, a lot of obor is already built in Central Asia anyway, the roads and the railway networks. And I mean, it even goes down to the fact where, you know, down to the level where the Chinese have bought or built oil refineries and gas stations and other services for the transport work, so that make sure that everything goes smooth. They send truck drivers in. They know that they can get gasoline, because they have oil refineries that are filling up service stations, which are also owned by the Chinese. One of the big questions for Central Asia about obor is, although the Chinese are helping to build all this stuff, there's a big question about who's going to maintain it in the future. China has been very generous in extending loans, and you know, as we've heard, the laborers come and help to build all these things. What's unclear is who's going to keep it repaired 10 years from now, and that's one of the things Central Asia has to worry about.
Thank you, Bruce. There are obviously lots of unanswered questions yet about the implications of the project.
Can I add something?
Sure, please, go on.
I would like to add something to Dr. Lewis said. I think he mentioned about the migration of Chinese to certain countries covered by this obor project. I think there are some challenges. For example, in Central Asia, there are some concerns regarding the flow of migrants from China. For example, Chinese construction companies, they have poor track record because of the bad quality of roads they built and mistreatment of local workers. And there are some conflicts also with local people. And that's why when it comes to the ordinary people, they fear of Chinese expansion. So I think this is going to be challenging.
Obvious.
If China will bring own people to these countries.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, this is a challenge, but as I understand, Dr. Lewis, you saying that obor does not allow flow of labor migration across border, right?
Well, let me clarify a bit. When China invests in Central Asia, it often does bring Chinese workers with it. And when Chinese investors invest in, say, a factory or in agriculture, they often also want to bring in Chinese workers. So there is a process of migration. It's not perhaps as big as some people think, but clearly, as just being mentioned, there have been problems in relations between local population in Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan in particular, and some Chinese workers in the oil industry or in mining, for example, in Kyrgyzstan, there's been that kind of problem. So there is a tension around migration that's quite important, potentially rather dangerous. But what it doesn't do is allow for alternative routes of migration for Central Asians, mm-hmm. right? There's no real option to go and work in China. Mm-hmm. Still, the option is to go and work primarily in Russia and in the Russian Federation.
So it
gives Russia still an important economic lever in Central Asia.
So it is kind of one way flow of migration, you know, labor force that is.
Yeah, I think the alternative flow, of course, you can also think about increasing numbers of students going to study in China from Kazakhstan, for example, and Kyrgyzstan. There's a lot of Chinese government scholarships for Central Asians. So at a different level, there are people going to work in China. And some of those will stay there and do business there and so on and so forth. Mm. So there is increasing cross-border interaction. But I think for people who are suffering unemployment in Central Asia, say, it will still be easier to go to Russia than it will be to go to China or other parts of East Asia.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Lewis. Just to recap one more time on today's Majlis, Arif Yaril's Central Asia podcast, we are discussing OBOR, China's One Belt, One Road project, and I am joined by some of the bright minds on the subject. Dr. David Lewis, senior lecturer at the Exeter University, is joining us from London. Cholopon Orozobekova, a Kyrgyz journalist and researcher, joining us from Geneva today. Bruce Pioneer, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlak Awazi, is with us from Prague. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Now, we are talking about huge money, huge infrastructure, a project that involves more than, you know, half of the world's population, obviously an ambitious project. What's the guarantee, Dr. Lewis, that it will indeed happen and it will be implemented?
Well, the short answer is that there is no guarantee. Obviously, as we know, there's also a slowdown going on in the Chinese economy. And so these very ambitious plans, which require a lot of funding, may be more difficult than was considered. One of the rationales for the project is actually to boost the Chinese economy, of course, by encouraging state companies to go out and find business elsewhere outside China. But clearly, if there are major problems in the China economy, then that could be a challenge. I think there's also a problem between, you know, how Central Asian governments respond to this, right? So if Uzbekistan doesn't launch any economic reforms or doesn't open up its borders and cross-border trade, it's going to be very difficult to really benefit significantly from any new infrastructure investment. Mm-hmm. So there's no guarantee. And then thirdly, I mean, it's also worth remembering that this is not just about roads and pipelines. It's also, it's an ideological project, right? It's about promoting a different kind of economic development, very different from the West's approach in many ways, where the state-led development and very infrastructure-heavy. And there are some real problems with that development model, and it may not work very well in Central Asia. So there's a lot of questions around the whole project, but its significance is much wider than Central Asia. You know, if it works in Central Asia, it may well work in other places, and will confirm and sort of legitimize the Chinese economic model. So I think there are some big geopolitical questions around it and some ideological questions that also need to be answered.
I'm very sorry, Dr. Lewis, in the absence of our other China expert today on the Majlis, we are relying on you on this subject mostly. Just a follow-up question on that subject. In terms of financial aspect of this project, obviously lots of money is coming from China. If a road to be built or a port to be constructed in Turkmenistan somewhere, who is going to finance that one? Is there anything that Central Asian governments like Turkmenistan is expected to contribute in this construction of this chain of various projects?
It varies from project to project. Certainly, in many cases, governments have paid their own share. So, for example, in the new railway inside Uzbekistan between Angren and Pap, the Uzbek government contributed a large part of that. funding. The Chinese Exim Bank gave, I think, around $350 million. And the World Bank also contributed significantly with their own investment. So what you're seeing is often a multiple partners involved. In Tajikistan, one of the new projects is a joint project between the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development and the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, China's other big investment initiative. So that's the sort of joint China-Western project, which is also very innovative and very new. So we'll have to see how this works out. But what China's trying to do, I think, is draw in other partners where possible to make it less of a clearly Chinese initiative, if you like, and thereby avoid any problems that might emerge with these projects as they go forward. So I think you'll see other funding initiatives going in there. And yes, when there is a possibility, they'll also try and find government funding from inside Central Asia itself.
Bruce, you heard the challenges that Dr. Lewis mentioned, and then also possibility of Chinese companies or other companies coming into the region, investing in various projects that includes agriculture or other sectors in the finance, and also possibility of China bringing its own labor force when it's investing on a project in various countries in Central Asia. And also, in addition to that, is most of the finances coming from China. So what does it say about China's future rule in the region?
Well, at least for the near term and probably midterm, they're going to have quite a large role in the region. And I think all the Central Asian governments are deep in debt to them at this moment already. You know, how much of a long-lasting inroad this is going to be is of course a big question. I've witnessed Chinese workers out there in Kyrgyzstan, and they're separated from the Kyrgyz workers. They were working on the roads, both in the north and the south. And there was one team that was the Chinese team, and they were working on one part of the road. And there was one team that was the Kyrgyz team, and they were working on another part of the road. The Chinese had their own accommodations established somewhere at a point along these roadsides. They did not mix very much with the Kyrgyz. And so I don't really know how much influence the Chinese would have long term. Now, that said, of course, oil and gas projects are a little bit different, where they require constant upkeep and someone has to be there all the time. And they seem to be well entrenched in areas in western Kazakhstan and south Afghanistan, for instance. I don't see them going away anytime soon at all from those particular jobs. But at the same time, Central Asia hasn't. The Central Asians that I've seen and that I've spoken with don't gravitate to China. Dr. Lewis has already pointed out that there's not really any out migration from Central Asia to China, and there's not really that much of a desire on the parts of the Central Asians to really go there or to mix very much with the Chinese. So that's why I don't think they have a very heavy footprint, except in areas where there's resources and where they'll have crews long term. Otherwise, you know, they're helping out with the money and they expect they'll get their share back for all these loans that they're putting in. But culturally, they don't seem to be making a very big impact on Central Asia so far.
And politically?
You know, they don't mix with internal affairs of the Central Asian governments, which is one of the things the governments in the region love about doing business with China, is whatever political problems that the Central Asian governments face, whatever crises, internal crises they face, China is supportive of the governments that are in place right now. They would prefer that, you know, Beijing would prefer the status quo. It's working for them very well. They don't want to see things change. So I don't see, you know, outside of like the extreme economic influence China has, I don't see at the moment that they have a huge political influence. That said, since all the governments owe them a lot of money, one would imagine that China does have some influence on some things or certainly if China expressed discontent with a foreign policy move a particular Central Asian government would do, that discontent would carry a lot of weight in the decision-making process, whether it's Tashkent, Bishkek, Astana, Ashgabat, or Dushanbe.
Even that is a little bit scary picture when you look into the region from Moscow's perspective. I think, Cholpan, you were talking about that China already being a biggest trade partner of five Central Asian countries compared to Russia. I think this is a figure coming from 2013 that the China's annual trade turnaround reaching to $50 billion with Central Asian countries versus Russia's trade amounts only $30 billion in a year. It's a huge, huge threat if you look into this from the Russian perspective. So what's the thinking, in your opinion, in Moscow about the UBOR, about this, all the scenario of UBOR and Chinese companies coming to Central Asia, building all this infrastructure and labor market coming to Central Asia?
If you remember last year, Chinese and Russian presidents, they met and they agreed that they have to connect UBOR and Eurasia Economic Union. So far there's no any movement regarding this decision. Mm-hmm. But I know that only there was feasibility study. But when it comes to Moscow, I think Russia is very cautious when it comes to Chinese any economic projects. But China also denies any political agenda. But we don't have to forget that geopolitical aspect of this issue. These two great powers, they compete for the influence in the region. For China, for example, of course, it's important energy resources. I agree with experts who say that these two great powers, they have to make a right division of labor. For example, in my opinion, if China is an economic hegemon being responsible of the Asian infrastructure, for example, Russia should secure its place as a guarantor of security. For example, Russia has military bases, arms deals. So this is going to be right division of labor, in my opinion. But both countries, they can continue an economic project. Currently, for example, Russia is in the difficult position with the heat of the low oil prices, ruble invaluation, and the international sanctions. So that's why maybe in the last several years, Moscow little changed it changed its position, I think.
Also about the possible political and security challenges to this project, and I'm sorry that we missed our other guest who was participating from Islamabad today. In Pakistan leg of UBOR, for example, it already become a contentious subject there. The Pakistan branch is being built under 24 hours watchful eyes of the military and several soldiers. Also, soldiers already being killed in protecting the construction. Obviously, there is no comparison, between Pakistan and Central Asia. But in terms of political challenge, Central Asian countries have a unique set of problems. So what are some of the possible political and security challenges that this project might face in Central Asia, Bruce?
Well, it certainly is going to have a lot. There's going to be a lot more things transiting through the region. I wouldn't say... this project is more about trade than it is about moving people around for the most part. So I don't see a huge security risk so much. The bigger problem, I think, regionally speaking...
But think about, Bruce, the embassy bomb blast in Bishkek in front of the Chinese embassy I'm referring to. I don't know whether it's relevant to this project or in China's increasing rule in Central Asia or not. But again, there is some level of security challenge time to time emerges.
Yeah, difficult to say. And I suppose if you want to, looking at it from that perspective, if you're anti-Chinese for whatever reason and you're looking for soft targets, you might be able to find some of them in Central Asia. So, I mean, I could see that. But I still think the biggest challenge is going to be regionally because it always demands a level of cooperation that China has been able to orchestrate fairly well in Central Asia to date. But we also know that traditionally, at least in the last 25 years, the Central Asian governments have not been very good at cooperating. So you close a road or are slow to fix a railway track or something like that, and it bottles up the whole network or at least part of the network in one place. And accusations go back and forth about who's responsible for that and are they working as quickly as they can to do it. These are the kind of complications I foresee. We already know that Central Asia is on lockdown because they've got their own concerns about Islamic extremism. They got the embassy. There was a bombing outside the embassy in Bishkek, the Chinese embassy in Bishkek. It's very unclear still exactly what was going on there with all this. The Kyrgyz government has spun their own theory about that, and there's still some holes in that argument that need to be filled in by the authorities there. But like I said, Central Asia is already on high alert for Islamic extremism. So I don't see that this particularly adds to the security threat. But I see the biggest threat as being the fact that, it demands cooperation among the regional states so that there's a free flow of goods all the time. And that's something that's been proven a challenge to them in the past.
I know, Dr. Lewis, you wanting to leave us, but just a final question, if you can. There is not much of the discussion about possible environmental challenge of the project, and China is not really known with its sensitivity towards the ecology when it comes to economic interests at stake. So what are the ecological concerns in Central Asia in terms of Ubur?
Well, there's a number of concerns, and some of them are specifically to do with China, and some are more general. Obviously, China is investing heavily in the kind of industries that do have environmental problems, like mining. So we've seen a number of occasions when environmental concerns have been raised by protesters around the mining sector in Kyrgyzstan, sometimes real concerns, sometimes linked to political campaigns as well. But, for example, cement plants, several new plants in the region in Kyrgyzstan and in Tajikistan recently, new cement plants developed by China. They're notoriously rather polluting industries and can have a really negative effect on local people. Same with refineries. A refinery in Karabaltar has some problems as well in this area. So I think one of the issues will be how governments regulate investment, make sure environmental rules are followed, because this creates a good deal of social discontent and popular opinion against China as part of broader environmental issues. So obviously some environmental problems are inevitable when you're building big infrastructure projects, but the problem is they're not very well managed often by Chinese companies, and so they can create serious popular discontent in the region. So I think these are some of the big problems that haven't always been thought through when these rather great, grand-sounding rhetorical ideas are thought up. Security, you mentioned, is also a big deal potentially, as Bruce emphasized with the bombing in Bishkek, and also just the general sense of, you know, much more visibility for China in the region, a lot of workers in the region. When there was unrest in Osh in 2010, China had to evacuate more than 1,000 Chinese citizens from that region. So the more China goes outside China and invests heavily, the more vulnerable it is in security terms as well. So there's lots for China to think about as it tries to develop this project more effectively.
Okay. I would like to add something, Muhammad. Sure. So we have to add here that China is relocating heavy enterprises to Kyrgyzstan. So this year, Bishkek and Beijing, they signed an agreement to relocate 40 Chinese factories, including steel plants as well. So this is going to raise ecological concerns in the future, I think.
Right. Bruce, final point, please. We have to conclude our discussion as our guests wanting to leave.
I'll just get back to the point of it being this helps Central Asia really, really long term. This is great for Central Asia. Even Kazakhstan's President Nursultan Nazarbayev said a couple years ago that ultimately Central Asia is going to be a transit region. That's its future. It'll run out of oil, it'll run out of gas, it'll run out of uranium and all kinds of other stuff that it mines, whatever. But for Central Asia, 100 years from now, the most important thing is to be part of major transportation links for trade. And so Obor is a great start at linking Central Asia to the rest of the world. And, they've been saying for years, the heart of the Eurasian landmass. And that's what it is. And so that is the future of Central Asia, is a transportation hub that connects the east and the west and the north and the south to each other. And like I said, this is the first big example of that that's going on right now with the One Belt, One Road initiative.
Okay, thank you very much, Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Uwazi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog. Also, big thanks goes to Dr. David Lewis, senior lecturer at the Exeter University in UK, Cholopon Orozovekova, Geneva-based journalist and researcher who's originally from Kyrgyzstan. Thank you very much for being part of the Majlis today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining the debate. This is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis. Until next week, bye-bye.